From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Remnant Group is an extremely interesting organization. It's hired by the CIA and the Pentagon to help put in leaders when the CIA wants regime change someplace. And it's been doing this for more than 15 years now, ever since Panama. So it's a private company that gets involved in helping replace leaders when the CIA wants regime change.
Journalist James Bamford looks at the man who sold the war in Iraq, John Rendon, Bush's general in the propaganda war. Then from Iraq to Vietnam, we speak with former presidential candidate George McGovern. A new film looks at his run for president in 1972.
I think that's a lot of nonsense, this charge that I was too decent and too nice a guy to be president. We've had too much indecency.
We did not trade weapons
or anything else.
He was developing a...
Repeat, did not.
A program for weapons of mass destruction.
And as one whose heart has ached for the past 10 years over the agony of Vietnam, I will halt the senseless bombing of Indochina on inaugural day.
One bright, shining moment. The forgotten summer of George McGovern. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 110 people have died since Friday in a series of bombings. On Saturday, a suicide attacker killed at least 36 people participating in a Shiite funeral procession north of Baghdad. A car bomb outside the capital killed 13 people. On Friday, at least 74 people died in an attack on a mosque near the Iranian border. Meanwhile, five members of an Iraqi family have been killed after U.S. forces opened fire on their vehicle outside a military base near Bakuba. Iraqi police said two men and three children were killed and two women and a child were wounded. Witnesses said the family was traveling to a funeral at the time. Military officials claim the car was shot at after the driver ignored orders to stop. And the Independent of London is reporting British-trained Iraqi police operating in Basra have tortured at least two civilians to death with electric drills. Their bodies were later found with drill holes to their arms, legs, and skulls. In news from Capitol Hill, the debate over the Iraq war has intensified to levels not seen even before Congress voted to approve the invasion. On Sunday, Democratic Congressmember John Murtha appeared on Meet the Press to repeat his call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
I'm absolutely convinced that we're making no progress at all. And I've been complaining for 2 years that there's an overly optimistic, an illusionary process going on here. They keep trying to measure Iraqi troops by our standards. They don't even need to meet our standards. And until we turn it over to the Iraqis, we're going to continue to do the fighting. Our young men and women are going to continue to suffer. I go to the hospitals almost every week. I'm going to go out there again this week. And I see these young people doing the fighting, and it's time to turn it over to the right. Give them the incentive to do the fighting themselves. They'll have to work this out themselves. This is their country. We've become the enemy. 80% of the people in Iraq want us out of there. 45% say it's justified to attack Americans. It's time to change direction.
That was Congressmember John Murtha, the top Democrat on the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee and a 37-year Marine veteran. He's long been considered a Democratic hawk. Last week, the White House immediately attacked Murtha following his call for troop withdrawal. White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan said, quote, "It's baffling that he's endorsing the policy positions of Michael Moore and the extreme liberal wing of the Democratic Party." On Friday, Congressmember Murtha was called a coward on the floor of the House by newly elected Republican Congressmember Jean Schmidt.
"A few minutes ago, I received a call from Colonel Danny Bupp, Ohio representative from the 88th District in the House of Representatives. He asked me to send Congress a message, stay the course. He also asked me to send Congressman Murtha a message that cowards cut and run, Marines never do. Danny and the rest of America and the world want the assurance from this body that we will see this through."
The House will be in order. The House will be in order. The House will be in order.
Ohio Congressmember Jean Schmidt. Then on Friday night, the Republican leadership moved to silence Murtha's criticism by introducing a bill that was worded in a manner designed to split the Democratic Party. The Republican bill proposed, quote, the deployment of United States forces in Iraq be terminated immediately. The bill was rejected 403-3. The only legislators backing the measure were Democrats Cynthia McKinney of Georgia, Jose Serrano of New York, and Robert Wexler of Florida. McKinney lashed out at the Republicans for distorting Murtha's message. She said, quote, they took his words and contorted them. They took his heartfelt sentiments and spun them. They took his resolution and deformed it in a cheap effort to silence dissent in the House of Representatives, she said. In other Iraq news, five senior officials from Germany's Federal Intelligence Service have told the Los Angeles Times they warned U.S. intelligence authorities that information provided by a top Iraqi informant, codenamed Curveball, could not be trusted or confirmed. Despite the questions about Curveball's veracity, the Bush administration issued dire warnings about Iraq's biological weapons program based on his claims. President Bush repeatedly said Iraq had mobile factories brewing biological poisons. Then Secretary of State Colin Powell told the United Nations in February 2003 that these labs could brew enough weapons-grade microbes in a single month to kill thousands upon thousands of people, he said. The Germans were shocked to hear Powell's speech. One official said, quote, we had always told them it was not proven, it was not hard intelligence. A month after Powell's speech, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix announced inspectors in Iraq had found no evidence of mobile biological production facilities in Iraq. But Blix's announcement drew little notice at the time, and the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq began 2 weeks later. Curveball was an Iraqi exile who moved to Germany in 1999. The LA Times reports the CIA corroborated Curveball's story with three sources. Two had ties to Ahmed Chalabi of the Iraqi National Congress. All three turned out to be frauds. Curveball claimed his brother was Chalabi's bodyguard. In Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has quit the Likud party and plans to start a new political party. His announcement came just hours after he asked the Israeli president to dissolve the Knesset and call for early elections. Also today, Sharon called the first meeting of prospective members of his new National Responsibility Party. Sharon's aides have reportedly said he wants to break with Likud hardliners who oppose the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. Sharon's announcement came a day after the Labor Party, under the new leadership of Amir Peretz, voted to leave Sharon's coalition government. A former aide of Congressmember Tom DeLay is expected to plead guilty today to conspiring with Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff to bribe government officials, including a congressmember, and bilk millions of dollars from Native American tribes. The official, Michael Scanlon, worked as a press aide to DeLay and later became a prominent public relations executive. He's reportedly agreed to work with federal prosecutors investigating Abramoff. Scanlon's accused of working with Abramoff in a scheme in which the lobbyist would direct tribes to hire Scanlon's public relations firm without telling them. Scanlon had agreed to kick back half the profits to Abramoff. The pair received $82 million in lobbying and PR fees from half a dozen tribes. Prosecutors charged Scanlon and Abramoff conspired to bribe Republican Robert Ney, who is referred to in the charging document as Representative Number One. Thomas Mann, a congressional specialist at the Brookings Institution, said, quote, I think this has the potential to be the biggest scandal in Congress in over a century. Meanwhile, newly disclosed documents show Abramoff asked the president of the West African nation of Gabon for $9 million in order to set up a White House meeting with President Bush. In other lobbying news, more than 60 lobbyists helped organize a $200,000 fundraising party for Tom DeLay Thursday night. The Washington Post reported the event was expected to be the largest fundraiser for a single member of Congress this year. Among the hosts were lobbyists from the American Petroleum Institute and the Edison Electric Institute. Earlier this year, DeLay helped push through an energy bill that included nearly $15 billion in oil and energy industry subsidies. Tom DeLay was recently forced to step down from his role as House Majority Leader after a Texas grand jury indicted him on conspiracy and money laundering charges stemming from a long-running campaign finance investigation. In Georgia, an estimated 19,000 people demonstrated outside Fort Benning, calling for the closing of the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, formerly known as the School of the Americas. It was the largest protest to date for the annual event. 40 arrests were made. Protest organizers said the U.S. military has used the school to train Latin American military officials to torture. The protests are timed to coincide with the anniversary of the November 1989 murders of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in El Salvador. The weekend demonstration comes just weeks after it was revealed that Vice President Dick Cheney was seeking congressional approval for CIA interrogators to engage in torture. Meanwhile, in London, Amnesty International opened a three-day conference Saturday on human rights, prevention of torture and detentions. Amnesty said it's the largest gathering of former Guantanamo detainees and their families held yet. Former Guantanamo detainee Mozam Beg spoke to Amnesty ahead of the conference.
The people that claim to be the upholders and defenders of freedom are debating now whether it is legitimate to use torture. After all of what the whole world's been through, arguing against the fact. And if it does, in one way or another, become legitimized, either mental torture or physical or psychological, in which has been clearly used by several countries, then I think that the world will spiral into something that nobody will be able to control.
Former Guantanamo detainee Mozam Beg interviewed by Amnesty International. In California, more than 1,000 people gathered outside San Quentin State Prison Saturday to call on Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger to halt the execution of former gang leader Stanley Tookie Williams. Williams helped start the Crips Street Gang, but behind bars, he's become a leading advocate for the end of gang violence. He's written 9 books and has been nominated several times for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's scheduled to die on December 13th. Among the protesters were the hip-hop artist Snoop Dogg, who called for Governor Schwarzenegger to halt Williams' execution.
We all about one thing, humanity, man. It's about keeping this man alive because his voice needs to be heard. Anytime you got a voice that's saving lives and trying to, you know, put people in a different position where they don't have to shoot, kill, rob, murder, where they can talk about their problems and converse and try to understand that we're just a conversation away from peace, you got to keep that alive.
Rap artist Snoop Dogg. And this update on the CIA leak case. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald said Friday he plans to present new evidence to another federal grand jury. The announcement comes 3 weeks after an earlier grand jury indicted Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. Last week, investigators questioned Washington Post assistant managing editor Bob Woodward for 2 hours after learning that a senior administration official revealed Valerie Plame's identity to him in mid-June 2003. There's been great speculation over who within the Bush administration might have been Woodward's source. The Times of London claims it's Stephen Hadley, who's now Bush's national security advisor. At the time, Hadley was deputy national security advisor under Condoleezza Rice. Newsweek magazine has suggested it might be former deputy secretary of state Richard Armitage. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the debate over the Iraq War ignited an explosion of angry words and personal insults between Democrat and Republican lawmakers on the House floor Friday. Democrats reacted furiously to attacks on John Murtha, the veteran congressmember who'd called on Thursday for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq within 6 months. Republican leaders hastily scheduled a vote on a non-binding resolution to immediately withdraw troops from Iraq. Democrats called the proposed measure a political farce. It was rejected 403-3. The emotionally charged debate comes as the issue of pre-war intelligence remains in the spotlight. In the latest news, 5 senior German officials reportedly warned U.S. intelligence authorities in the run-up to the invasion that a top Iraqi informant named Curveball could not be trusted or confirmed. Despite the warnings, the Bush administration used its claims to help justify the war. Earlier this month, Democrats forced the Senate into an unusual closed session to question pre-war intelligence and claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The move came 1 week after the indictment of Vice President Cheney's chief of staff for his involvement in the CIA leak case, in which the identity of an undercover CIA operative, Valerie Plame, was exposed after her husband, Joseph Wilson, criticized the Bush administration's use of a debunked piece of evidence for WMDs in Iraq. So how did the Bush administration sell the war to the American public? Well, there's a new article in Rolling Stone magazine that examines just that. In it, investigative journalist James Bamford looks at the role of one of the most powerful public relations firms in Washington, D.C., in setting the stage for the Iraq War. The firm's the Rendon Group. Its founder and CEO is John Rendon. Rendon's a former executive director of the Democratic National Committee, also worked for President Jimmy Carter as the director of scheduling. He was also the state coordinator in Maine for the McGovern campaign. Bamford writes that the Pentagon secretly awarded Rendon a $16 million contract to target Iraq and other adversaries with propaganda. One of the most powerful people in Washington, John Rendon's a leader in the strategic field known as perception management, manipulating information and, by extension, the news media to achieve the desired result. His firm has made millions off government contracts since 91, when it was hired by the CIA to help, quote, create the conditions for the removal of Hussein from power. James Bamford joins us in our Firehouse studio here in New York, the author of several books, including the first one ever written about the National Security Agency called The Puzzle Palace, Inside America's Most Secret Intelligence Organization. His latest book is A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you with us. Well, this piece in Rolling Stone is quite a read. Why don't you start off by talking about a man in the Gulf of Thailand who was taking a lie detector test?
Well, this took place in December of 2001. This is really the sort of opening shot of the propaganda war to get the United States into war. And the person being polygraphed was an Iraqi defector by the name of Al-Hadari. And the Iraqi National Congress, the INC, had brought him out of Iraq and brought him to Thailand, primarily to expose him to the media and to try to get his story told. And what his story was that Saddam Hussein had not only chemical and biological weapons, but even nuclear weapons and precursors to nuclear weapons hidden in Iraq in various places. Some of the biological weapons were supposedly hidden under the main hospital in Baghdad, for example. So it was an amazing story, and this was the up until this time, there was a lot of speculation in the press and in Congress and other places about what Saddam may have, what might have been left over from the Gulf War and so forth. But this was going to be the very first time that somebody could actually point to information as proof, having seen these where these things were buried and so forth. So the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, which was led by Ahmed Chalabi, decided to call in two journalists to broadcast this information the world.
First, the lie detector proved
exactly. Before the before he actually called these people in to broadcast this information, obviously the CIA had a big interest in this and the Pentagon had a big interest in this. So the CIA flew a polygraph operator with his machine all the way over to the Thailand, Pattaya, Thailand, which is south of Bangkok, and they went into a hotel room, they strapped up Al-Hadari, and they asked him all these questions. And they went over and over for hours his allegations regarding weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they came away with charts that indicated he was deceptive, that he was lying, that this was not true. And they flew back to Washington, and presumably, assuming this is going to be the end of it. But that is information that was never made public. They didn't broadcast that information. So what happened was the INC and Chalabi decided to take that bogus information that Al-Hadari was giving and broadcast it around the world. So they called in two journalists. One of the journalists was Judy Miller, who was given the worldwide print exclusive rights to the story.
And who called her in?
Chalabi called her in. Chalabi asked her if she wanted to do the story, and she flew from Washington all the way over to Bangkok to interview Al-Hadari.
Chalabi on the payroll of the CIA.
At this time, Chalabi was, he'd been getting money from the CIA up until the mid-90s, and then he started getting money from the Pentagon after the CIA failed to trust him anymore. So the other journalist that they called in was Paul Moran, who was a journalist working for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. And what makes this very interesting was how this came about. The people setting this up were members of the INC, whose main goal all along from the very beginning was overthrowing Saddam Hussein any way possible. And ironically, one of the people they called in, Paul Moran, had formerly worked for the INC, and he'd also worked for another company called the Rendon Group.
Hold it there. We have to break. When we come back, we'll take a look at the Rendon Group. We're talking to investigative reporter James Bamford, author of A Pretext for War, has just written a piece in Rolling Stone called The Man Who Sold the War. Stay with us. Velvet Underground here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 400 radio and TV stations around the country. On Pacifica NPR, college and community radio stations, as well as low-power FM stations. On public access TV, as well as PBS, and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is James Bamford. He's written the piece in Rolling Stone magazine, The Man Who Sold the War. Meet John Rendon, Bush's general in the propaganda war. So, the Rendon Group and John Rendon.
That's right. The Rendon Group plays an important part in this because it was the Rendon Group, who few people have heard about, that actually set up the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, in the first place. In a very unusual move, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, outsourced the propaganda for the war in Iraq basically to a private company.
Why?
And the reason they did it was because they specialized in this. The Rendon Group, for years, had been able to take information that the CIA was trying to get across to the public and broadcast it. For example, they went back to Panama just before the U.S. Action in Iraq in 1990. The Bush administration invaded Panama and ousted Manuel Noriega. Well, all along, the CIA had a person they wanted to put in there to take Noriega's place, a person by the name of Indira. And the CIA outsourced to the Rendon Group the propaganda campaign to put Indira in there. So they took this person who was basically a lawyer, a businessman, and Rendon built him up into a presidential candidate, took him around Europe, introduced him to the Pope. And when his group was attacked, one of his vice presidents was attacked, a very bloody attack. It made the front page of newspapers all over the world, including Time magazine.
With the Rendon Group's help getting
the image
out. Exactly.
The Rendon Group is the public relations group that pushed all that information out there. So,
John Rendon flying in a few minutes before the actual invasion took place of Panama.
Well, as the invasion took place, before the planes actually started attacking, John Rendon was in a plane about to land in Panama. So he was there right at the beginning, and he was there to right about the same time that his candidate, Indira, was sworn in as president. So he did such a good job in Panama in terms of regime change, getting the CIA's man into office. The Bush administration decided, the first Bush administration decided to use him to help do regime change in Iraq. And after the first Gulf War, the whole idea was to oust Saddam Hussein and put in Ahmad Chalabi as the leader. So John Rendon, his company, the Rendon Group, created a umbrella group known as the Iraqi National Congress.
He came up with the name?
And John Rendon came up with the name. He formed an organizational meeting in Vienna. He helped install Chalabi as the head of the group, and then the money was originally funneled from the CIA through the Rendon Group, about $350,000 a month, to Chalabi. And
was this also for deniability, so it wouldn't be the CIA directly giving the money?
Well, definitely. That's one of the key reasons that they wanted to use a private company like the Rendon Group as a cutout. And they did that in Panama also. So it was a very convenient organization to turn to in order to help regime change. The CIA could help in terms of the combat, overthrowing a foreign leader like Saddam Hussein. But in terms of building up the world propaganda, number one, hating Saddam Hussein. Number two, loving Ahmad Chalabi. That was something that they had to outsource, and the Rendon Group had become specialists in that type of propaganda.
We're talking with investigative reporter Jim Bamford, author of A Pretext for War. That's his book. The Man Who Sold the War is the name of his article in Mother Jones. So let's go back. In Rolling Stone magazine. Let's go back to Judith Miller and Paul Moran. One is a radio reporter who worked for the Rendon Group, and you could talk about that. And the other, Judith Miller, worked for the New York Times.
That's right. And how this comes full circle is that the Rendon Group created the INC, put in Chalabi in there, and then now we have December of 2001, right after the September 11th attacks, and while the administration is gearing up to sort of get the public behind the administration and going into war in Iraq. So you, up until this time, it had been all speculation about what had been going on in terms of Saddam's use of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And now the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, comes up with this defector who is telling this huge lie about where all these weapons are being hidden.
And they know it's a lie.
Well, I don't know when they knew it, but they certainly should have known it at some point, that the CIA person walked out of the room, wasn't smiling about all the happy news he was hearing.
And the guy who did the lie detector test said he's not telling the truth.
That's right, exactly. And it didn't seem to make much difference, because they called in the press, and the two people that they called in, ironically, one of them was Paul Moran, who had formerly worked not only for the INC but also for the Rendon Group. So you have a journalist who has a worldwide broadcast exclusive for this interview with this defector who's telling a lot of lies, who actually had formerly worked for the group putting this show on the road. And then they called in Judy Miller, who was going to be granted the worldwide print exclusives. And Judy Miller, in her own words, in a memo she wrote to her bureau chief in Baghdad at one point, mentioned that for a decade, Chalabi had been one of her key sources, and that he was responsible for many of the front page stories on WMD in the New York Times. So they called in these two very sympathetic journalists to broadcast this story. And it made huge news. It came out, I think it was December 20th, 2001. And again, it made a great impact because this was the first time that an actual eyewitness was able to say that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. So this was a major milestone in the road to the war. And from then on, the INC began coming up with other defectors, and the New York Times and other organizations started promoting the war. But it had a lot of it had its origins with this first defector, al-Hadary.
James Bamford Palmeran died in Iraq.
And one of the biggest and most tragic ironies of the entire war was the fact that this journalist, Palmeran, who had formerly worked for both the INC and the Rendon Group, and then had the worldwide broadcast rights for this story about Hadary, which helped push the U.S. into war with Iraq, into invading Iraq. Palmeran actually became the very first journalist killed in the war. He was in northern Iraq, and a car bomb exploded very close to him, and he was killed instantly. I think it was within 2 or 3 days of the beginning of the war. So it was a very tragic irony that Palmeran, who helped generate some of the early publicity for the war, ended up being one of the first people killed in the war.
John Rendon went to his funeral in Australia.
Yeah, so Rendon Group went to a lot of trouble and expense to really create a lot of memorials for Palmeran. John Rendon flew to the funeral in Australia. They had a memorial service for him in Washington. They had another larger memorial service for him in London, where Rendon and Palmeran first began working in around 1990. So it was a very big tragedy, and it was a tragedy for the Rendon Group, who had relied on Palmeran for many, many years.
Can you talk about the IOTF, what it stands for, and the Information War Room?
Well, the Information Operation Task Force was set up by the Pentagon because if you read some of the Pentagon documents that are coming out in the last few years, they wanted to turn information into a major weapon to use during a war. They realized with the internet and with the explosion of information technology around the world that getting a message out is extremely important. It's especially important in a case like this, where we weren't attacked by Iraq. This wasn't a case of the United States defending itself against an attack. So the United States had to go on a propaganda war in order to convince the world that this preemptive invasion had legitimacy. So in order to do that, the Pentagon created a number of organizations to help promote this information around the world, and the Information Operation Task Force was one of those, and the Rendon Group played an extremely important role in that. And one of the key objectives of the Rendon Group in this aspect was to analyze media all over the world. John Rendon, in my interview with him, and it was the first interview he's ever granted, or at least within probably 20 years.
And why did he grant it to you?
You're going to have to ask him. I don't ask questions. I'm very happy when somebody does agree to be interviewed. So and one of the ironic aspects of John Rendon is you have somebody here who started out as basically an anti-war activist. He went to work for the George McGovern campaign, actually ran the Maine operation, the operation up in Maine for George McGovern. So you have a person who started out as an anti-war activist and a lifelong Democrat, head of the Democratic National Committee, executive director of the DNC. And here he is the chief of propaganda for the Bush administration and their war with Iraq. So it was a very interesting progression. And when I interviewed him, he said he still never voted for a Republican. He still votes Democratic, and he donated money to the Democratic Party not long ago. So now what his role is this chief of propaganda, and as that, the Pentagon has been using him a great deal to analyze information around the world. Rendon told me that they analyzed something like 143 newspapers and a lot of broadcast media around the world, and that he prides himself on being able to get to policymakers information on what news organizations all over the world are going to do 6 hours before they actually do it. And that way, the Pentagon can prepare a response or some kind of rebuttal to whatever may be coming on a news organization hours in advance.
You write, James Bamford, a key weapon, according to documents, was Rendon's proprietary state-of-the-art newswire collection system called LiveWire, which takes real-time newswire services as they're filed before they're on the internet, before CNN can read them on the air, and 24 hours before they appear in the morning papers, and sorts them by keyword. The system provides the most current real-time access to news and information available to private or public organizations. The top target that the Pentagon assigned to Rendon was the Al Jazeera television network. The contract called for the Rendon Group to undertake a massive media mapping campaign against the news organization. Why? What did they do?
Well, it's a very interesting area, this media mapping. And basically what it is they were directed to take a close look at the actual reporters who are reporting the news. And analyze them. What is their slants? What's their bias? What's the background for these people? What makes that very worrisome is that there was another group that was set up by the Pentagon, Office of Strategic Influence, and that was eventually closed down. But one of the things that
because it became public.
That's right. When it came became knowledge, and one of the aspects was that they were going to plant phony stories and news organizations around the world. And when you plant a phony story in a news organization anywhere in the world today, I mean, it's immediately accessible to people in the United States. So it would have had a very bad blowback effect.
I remember when Rumsfeld closed it, he said, yeah, we may change the name, but it doesn't mean we have to stop doing what we're doing.
Exactly. And a lot of people believe that it sort of disappeared and then emerged secretly again someplace else in the Pentagon.
Would you say that was Douglas Feith's organization?
Yes, Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, set up that organization.
And it's now being investigated.
Yes, that's right. And again, as soon as the I think it was the New York Times came out with the story on it, and as soon as that happened, it was within weeks that Donald Rumsfeld closed it down, at least said he closed it down, or at least took that name away from it. But one of the aspects of that was to look very secretly at some of these journalists around the world, and that's what's worrisome when you do media mapping. I mean, how far do you go, and what are you going to do with journalists? And at the time, the Pentagon was claiming that Al Jazeera was aiding the enemy, aiding the Iraqi government, aiding the insurgency and so forth. So it's a very dangerous situation when you have part of the U.S. government acting secretly to do something about foreign media that may end up deceiving U.S. media back in the United States.
Now, you write, the secret targeting of foreign journalists may have had a sinister purpose. Among the missions proposed for the Pentagon's Office of Strategic Influence was one to coerce foreign journalists and plant false information overseas. Secret briefing papers also said the office should find ways to punish those who convey the wrong message. One senior officer told CNN the plan would formalize government deception, dishonesty, and information. Punish, coerce, how?
Well, I don't know. That's as far as the information we've been able to obtain has come out. But when you talk about punish and coerce, I mean, they've got very ominous definitions to them. How do you punish and coerce a foreign journalist? The Office of Strategic Influence was closed down, whether that aspect of it was also done away with, nobody knows at this point. John Rendon, during the interview, said his office or his company was not involved with the Office of Strategic Influence.
We're talking to James Bamford about the Rendon Group, about John Rendon, who heads up the group and what it has been doing. What is it doing today? What is he doing? This is a family organization?
Yes, it's very much a family organization. And again, another irony here is that the company has its main headquarters here in Washington. And again, the company is involved enormously with the CIA and the Pentagon, and has been over the years.
How much money have they gotten?
It's hard to say. I've seen between $50 and $100 million worth of contracts. They had 35 contracts in the last, I think, 3 or 4 years with the Pentagon.
His brother working out of Boston?
Yes. So down here in Washington, they deal with the CIA and the Pentagon, and Rendon actually said that they've been involved in every shooting conflict involving the United States since Panama. I think he mentioned 9 of them, all of them except for there was one that he mentioned the Horn of Africa, Somalia, that he wasn't involved in. He was involved in all the others. But the irony here is that they're involved in all this a very secret activity in Washington. On the other hand, the Rendon Group in Boston operates a very liberal sounding organization where they do public service announcements for the Museum of Fine Arts and work for Whale Conservancy and a number of other groups like that.
So, when you say coordinating Empower Peace, a campaign that brings young people in the Middle East in contact with American kids through video conferences.
That's right. So it's sort of the reverse image of what they're doing down here. And I mean, just to give you an idea of the secrecy that's involved with this organization in Washington, one of the contracts I found for the Rendon Group from the Pentagon said that they are cleared to research and analyze information classified top secret SCI, SI, TK, G, HCS.
Explain.
That's enormous. That's in the world of secrecy. That's a very big, a lot of secrecy. Each one of these, you start with top secret, and then all these afterwards are sort of what are known as code words, which indicate special access to information. Each of these are different. The SCI has to do with it's sensitive compartmented information. It usually deals with NSA information. SI is specifically NSA intercept information. TK stands for Tango Kilo or Talent Keyhole, which is the code word for imagery information. Top secret imagery information. G is very, very secret. NSA intercept information. It stands for Gamma, which is a code word. And HCS is Human Control System, which is very, very secret information from CIA human sources. So for a public relations firm to have all these clearances and accesses is rather extraordinary.
Why don't we wrap up with in the place where we began, with Adnan Ihsan Said al-Haidiri, who eventually the U.S. government brought back to Iraq, the man who in Thailand was given a lie detector test. He failed. And then Miller and Moran for ABC, Australian Broadcasting, and New York Times did not reveal this to in their articles, but said that this man who was in the know said that there are weapons of mass destruction. So he goes back to Iraq.
Yes, he goes back to Iraq after the U.S. invasion. And he's asked, well, okay, now's your opportunity. You can point out where all these facilities are located. And he couldn't find a single one. And these are, and he, at one point he said, well, they've moved them all. But the what he claimed originally was a lot of these were hidden in wells and other things. I mean, you don't move a well. Again, it sort of confirmed the polygraph operator's determination that this was all one big lie. Now, you know, you would think that even after that, that the U.S. government would disown al-Hadary after failing the polygraph and then failing to find the weapons of mass destruction. But before George Bush went to the U.N. to argue for war, he actually created a document, and they quoted from al-Hadary in that document. This was at least 9 months after the polygraph showed that he was lying. And even today, if you go on the White House webpage, they still have that document quoting from al-Hadary, not only after he flunked the polygraph, but after he failed to show where these weapons were in Iraq.
So al-Hadary fails a lie detector test, and the Bush administration quotes him. Ambassador Joe Wilson comes back and says that the nuclear weapons did not prove to be the case in Niger, and the Bush administration says the opposite.
Exactly. Even in, he didn't use his name, but even in George Bush's State of the Union address, he referred to the al-Hadary revelations. Again, this is information that his own agency said was wrong, was a lie. So it's very hard to justify.
Well, James Bamford, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Well,
James Bamford is the author of A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, and he wrote a piece in the current issue of Rolling Stone magazine called The Man Who Sold the War, talking about John Rendon and the Rendon Group. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go back in time from Iraq to Vietnam, and we'll speak with a former presidential candidate who also had to deal with lies around Vietnam. We'll speak with Senator George McGovern. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. In the past few weeks, new information has been revealed about the U.S. government's deceptions during the Vietnam War. Early this month, new evidence emerged about the Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964 that precipitated the escalation of Vietnam War. A National Security Agency historian determined officers at the agency knowingly falsified intelligence in order to make it look as if North Vietnam had attacked the U.S. destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf. Following the alleged attack, President Johnson ordered retaliatory airstrikes on North Vietnamese targets and used the event to persuade Congress to pass the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which led to the escalation of war. And just last week, documents were released from National Archives that gave fresh insight into the Nixon administration's efforts to deceive the public over the 1970 attack on Cambodia. Over 50,000 pages of declassified material include records of then-President Richard Nixon meeting with aides at a time Americans were told U.S. forces in Cambodia were there to support South Vietnamese. Nixon told aides, "This is what we will say publicly, but now let's talk about what we'll actually do." George McGovern was the Democratic presidential candidate in the 1972 race against Richard Nixon. McGovern, one of the leading critics of the Vietnam War in Washington. A new film that looks at his life has opened in Los Angeles. It's called One Bright and Shining Moment, The Forgotten Summer of George McGovern. It was produced and directed by Stephen Vittoria. I narrated the film. This is an excerpt.
It's hard to find a person who's run for something that has engendered as much affection as George McGovern has engendered.
Can you imagine if McGovern had become president?
From military spending so wasteful that it weakens our nation, come home, America.
Can you imagine a world without Madison Avenue-induced patriotism?
There were a lot of people who were threatened by George McGovern.
Nixon was good for black folk because he scared white folk.
You had the rise of the neoconservative movement.
All this talk about him as a softie was just preposterous. I mean, the man's an authentic American hero.
I think that's a lot of nonsense, this charge that I was too decent and too nice a guy to be president. We've had too much indecency.
We did not.
I believe.
Sexual trade weapons or anything else.
He was developing a.
Repeat. Did not.
A program for weapons of mass destruction.
And as one whose heart has ached for the past 10 years over the agony of Vietnam, I will halt the senseless bombing of Indochina on inaugural day.
Lies are natural to governments. They lie most about war.
Here in this chamber as we speak, the wings of the angel of death.
George McGovern wanted out. He wanted my friends and my relatives to come home and not in a body bag.
He at the same time had been talking about white racism at a time when everybody else was at most talking about the Negro problem.
American politics will never be the same again. George McGovern's clarion call to the American people.
Never again will we send the precious young blood of this country to die trying to prop up a corrupt military dictatorship abroad.
For once in American politics, sunshine and light beat shadows and fog.
We just lost an election. None of us went to jail. Most of the other guys went to jail.
One Bright and Shining Moment, The Forgotten Summer of George McGovern. It's opened in Los Angeles, narrated, produced and directed by Stephen Vittoria. George McGovern joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Former senator of South Dakota, ran against Richard Nixon in the historic 1972 presidential race. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Senator McGovern.
Thank you very much. It's nice to hear those words of the film is out on the 72 campaign. I still think that campaign was properly oriented, and we identified the central issue, which was a mistaken war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia.
We're talking a lot about lies today, and we are getting more information about the pretext for war back in Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin. What was your position at the time?
Well, I reluctantly supported that resolution because we were assured that two American destroyers operating on the high seas were attacked in an unprovoked, what was called an unprovoked attack by the North Vietnamese naval forces. Actually, we learned within a few months of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that there was no evidence that such an attack ever occurred. Even one of the commanders of one of the destroyers said at the time, hold up, we're not really sure that there was any attack. Lyndon Johnson himself said to his aides, it looks like those guys were shooting at whales out there. They're really, he began to doubt the substance of the resolution himself. But I think I've always thought that was a cooked-up deal. Even if there had been some kind of a PT boat attack on those destroyers, it wasn't unprovoked because those destroyers were out there harassing the North Vietnamese coastline. So that was a total fiction. totally without any foundation in fact.
Are you sorry you voted now?
Oh, absolutely.
What would you say about the Democrats today who voted for the invasion based on what they say now is false information, but saying they would do the same thing again? That goes right to John Kerry.
Yeah, well, I can't understand that position because I used to tell my daughters who were terribly discouraged about the war in Vietnam, the one good thing maybe out of this experience is that we'll never do that again. We'll never send American soldiers abroad on the flimsy excuses that took us into Vietnam, and yet here we are going right down the same road again. I couldn't understand people with any historic memory at all voting to authorize war against Iraq in view of the way we'd been so shamefully misled in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. I have to tell you, I don't think the Gulf of Tonkin incident was the cause of a major war against Vietnam. We were already escalating that war long before the Gulf of Tonkin. But I regret voting for it because it was based on falsehoods.
Senator McGovern, we just had an extended conversation about John Rendon, who in the latest issue of Rolling Stone magazine, the man who sold the war, Bush's general in the propaganda war, Rendon Group Key, getting tens of millions of dollars from the U.S. government, military, Pentagon. He was your man in Maine for your presidential election?
If he was, I've forgotten it. I have no knowledge of this man at all.
Well, let me ask about John Murtha and your thoughts about him today. The congressmember, the hawkish Democratic congressmember from Pennsylvania, has just turned around, said he was wrong, and wants the troops out immediately.
Well, that's a good American doctrine to be able to change your mind once you discover you're wrong. Since when is it considered a cowardice or being pro-terrorist to say we were mistaken in going into Iraq? I never did think that intervention in Iraq had anything to do with fighting terrorism. The Iraqis had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. Saddam Hussein was a big enough SOB without accusing him of something he had nothing to do with. And as the Congressman Murtha has concluded, we're actually creating terrorists in Iraq. There wasn't any big insurgency going on in Iraq at the time we put our army into their country. And I think that Congressman Murtha, who is an experienced combat veteran, 39 years in the United States Marine Corps, had every right to say, I've changed my mind, that it's time to come home. We've done everything we can there.
Perhaps most interesting, Senator McGovern, is not so much that he's being slammed by Republicans in Congress, but that the Democrats are not supporting him.
Well, some of the Democrats are supporting
him. Or they're distancing themselves from him.
Well, that may be. I think that's wrong. I think we should ought to get out of Iraq. I was saying we shouldn't go in there months before we went in. A lot of thoughtful people were saying that, including General Wesley Clark. Other people were warning us that this was a trap. It'd be easy to get into, but very hard to get out. And I think that Congressman Murtha has come to that conclusion and had the courage to say, I was wrong. I don't want to see any more Americans dying out there. Let's get out and do it in a systematic way.
Senator George McGovern, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Senator McGovern of South Dakota speaking to us from Los Angeles. And that does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. DemocracyNow.org is our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!